And at this time, it's my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker tonight, Terry Gorski from Chicago.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening and to have an opportunity to share with you some ideas and some thoughts about the concepts of intimacy and the concepts of relationship. And that's what I'm going to be talking with you about tonight, and that's what we're going to be looking at. When I was asked to do this, I was asked if I would address an issue with you that answers a question that just a couple of us may be concerned about. That question is, what is normal in a relationship? Have any of you ever asked yourself that question? What is normal? You know, now, in an attempt to answer that question, I did some looking into as many sources as I could find, and I was trying to answer the question, number one, how many people in the United States come from basically functional families? Okay? Now, a functional family, you know, what is a functional family? A functional family is a family of origin that basically equips a child with the emotional, intellectual, and relationship skills to deal with life as an adolescent and as an adult. And let's repeat that definition. A functional family is a family unit, a home, where a child learns the skills that are necessary to operate emotionally. In other words, I learn how to recognize what I feel, put labels on my feelings, and then tell other people what I feel. And conversely, I have the capacity to care about what others feel, to listen to their feelings and respond. That's criteria number one. Criteria number two is a functional family prepares a child to cope intellectually with the world. It teaches them how to think clearly and accurately without major denial. It teaches them how to see reality more or less for what it is. And then the third aspect of a healthy family is it teaches children, a functional family will teach children how to relate in a productive manner with other human beings in relationships. Now, what percentage of the adults living today come from healthy families? The best guesstimate I can give you is somewhere around 20 to 30% of the adults in the United States today have come from a functional family unit. If you happen to come from a dysfunctional family and you meet one of these people, it is a really strange experience. Now, I had this experience in a support group that I was involved in through a church that I participated in for a while. And we decided we would introduce ourselves to each other one night by telling the stories of our childhood. So I went first. Then everyone else came after me. And I sat there and I thought, for the people who came from functional families, I believe they were lying. I absolutely believe they were lying. I did not believe that they really got the kind of loving and caring that they received, that they were actually able to identify and talk about feelings, think clearly about reality, express opinions, and they actually learned how to cope with other people. Now, as a result of growing up in a dysfunctional family, we lose touch with the concept of what is a healthy relationship. Now, let me just pose one thing to you. If 20 to 30% of the adults in the United States today come from a functional family, 70 to 80% of the adults come from a dysfunctional family. Now, people who come from functional families have learned unconsciously how to relate in a productive, healthy, and intimate manner with others. If you come from a dysfunctional family, you have learned unconsciously and habitually to relate with others in a destructive style of intimacy. Now, if 80%, give or take 10 on either side, come from a dysfunctional family, what is normal? It is normal in the United States today to be dysfunctional in your relationships. And now I sit down. So what we are, and if you don't believe this, I encourage you to watch television. And take a look at the role models that are being held up to us and ask yourself, when was the last successful soap opera that you saw that role modeled healthy, intimate relationships? There are very few and far between. So what? Now, I'm suggesting that tonight we're going to ask a different question rather than what is normal, because I don't know about you, I don't want to become the norm of this society in terms of relating to others. I want to become abnormal. So I suggest we ask a different question. What is healthy in a relationship? What does it mean to have a healthy intimate, a healthy interpersonal relationship? And that's the question I'd like to address with you tonight. And I'd like to explore and invite you to think with me. Now, before we go into the actual examination of this issue, what is healthy, I'd like you to do something for just a moment with me. Healthy relationships are based upon the ability to do two basic things. And I'm going to ask you to do one of them right now. I'm just going to ask you to sit back for a moment, settle yourself into your chair, take a very deep breath, and notice what's going on inside the center part of your body, from the pit of your stomach on up to your throat. And take another deep breath and just notice that. And see if you can put a word label on that. Okay? And then I'm going to ask you to take another breath and notice if you've got a conversation going on in your head. Okay? And then I want you to just take another deep breath and notice if your mind has a tendency to go away to someplace special. Okay? And now come back out of yourself. And I want you to turn to somebody just to the side of yourself, and I want you to look the person next to you right in the eye and say hello and share with them a word or a phrase about what that experience was like for you to look inside of yourself. Take just a moment to do that. Let's stop. Now, what we just did in a little mini experiment is go through the process skills that are necessary for having a relationship. A relationship is simply the process of relating to another human being. And what does it mean to relate to? It means you do two things. You look within yourself to identify your inner experiences. What you are thinking, what you are feeling, what you are imagining, either through memory or through projecting into the future. Then you pull out of yourself and you connect with another human being and you tell them the nature of that inner experience. Then you shut up and listen to what the other person says to you in response. Those are the three basic skills of relationship. Look within and know what your experience is. Pull yourself out of yourself. Tell that to another human being. Shut up. Stay connected and attentive to the other person as they tell you what is then going on inside of them. Then you listen to that. Then you get back inside of yourself again and notice if your inner experience has changed. Pull yourself out, tell them how it's different now, what you're thinking differently, how you're feeling differently, what you're imagining differently, and then attend to what they are saying back. Simple, isn't it? Only if you've learned as a child and have unconsciously habituated by doing over and over again that process. Those three processes are what healthy, functional families teach children to do from the day they are born, through role modeling and practice and correction over and over again, so it becomes an unconscious habituated process. It is a process that people from dysfunctional families never learn, and as a result, sometimes as an adult, they have to start the painful process of taking each one of those behaviors apart, relearning them and doing them over and over and over again repeatedly until they get in the habit of doing it. And initially it's painful, but for those of you who have begun this process, it gets easier over time. Now, what I'm going to talk about is the process of building a healthy relationship by talking about, first of all, what levels do relationships operate under? People from dysfunctional families often fail to recognize that healthy relationships can operate on a number of different levels. And we're going to explore what those are and the types of problems that occur when one person's operating at one level of relationship while another person is operating at a different level of relationship and the expectations don't quite match. Have any of you experienced that? All of a sudden, you're not quite getting from your partner what you think you should be getting. But your partner is giving exactly what they choose to give. And it tends to bend us out of shape a little bit. We'll talk about that a little bit. The second thing we're going to talk about, the nature of dysfunctional or addictive relationships. The types of relationships that alcoholics tend to get into once they get sober. Drug-dependent people tend to get into once they get sober. Adult children tend to get into once they start growing up. And we're going to talk about what this is and try and examine it to see if perhaps we relate to this just a little bit. And then we're going to take a look at these characteristics and say, what are the healthy counterparts? If you are involved in a dysfunctional, an addictive style of relating to other human beings, can we set up a vision or a goal of what is healthy that we can start growing into? How can we set our goals for how we want to change our style and our method of relating? And then finally, I'm going to discuss some general steps for how you can begin the process of growing out of an addictive relationship style into a healthy relationship style. Now let's begin at the beginning. And this is the beginning because many times, people who come from dysfunctional families learn very early on they have two options, intense, painful involvement or isolation. There are two levels of relationship, abandonment or intense pain. That's it. And so I can choose. I can be totally alone till I hurt so bad I can't stand it. Or I can be dysfunctionally involved with a human being intensely until it hurts so bad I can't stand it. So life becomes a vacillation between painful loneliness and painful involvement. Anyone identifying with any of this? We fail to recognize that relationships operate on a continuum of levels. The first level is superficial involvement. Did any of you say hello to the nice people who are serving you dinner tonight?
Yeah.
Have you passed each other in the hallways and said, hi, how are you, shook hands, maybe even hugged each other? Never see that person again in the whole, maybe not even in the conference. But you're nice and you're pleasant and you're superficial. There's a housekeeper at work. There's a secretary at work. There's, you know, somebody, it's just very superficial, very pleasant. Superficial involvement occurs in relationships where people interact in a casual manner and have little investment in and absolutely no commitments to one another. Okay? Casual friends and short-term associates fall into this category. You ever met somebody you're kind of casually involved? You go out to dinner maybe, or a group of you after work say, well, let's go down the street, or you take a raft trip down a river, or you go on a skiing trip and you see people for a weekend. These are casual relationships, okay? Now, at times, these casual relationships may be sexual, and at other times, they may be non-sexual, okay? Now, so sexuality no longer is an indicator of intimacy in our culture, and this is an important thing to recognize. Simply because someone wants to be sexual with you, whether they be male or female, does not necessarily mean they want to be intimate with you. They may only seek a casual, superficial involvement sexually. And that pretty much morally is becoming acceptable as okay. You know, the cultural revolution has come and gone. And sexual practices have changed. Now, what if you desire more than this? Oh, by the way, most people from dysfunctional families feel guilty when they get involved in superficial relationships. I should be so much more to these people. And you find them rescuing housekeepers from their personal problems, and you find them, you know, they just, the tendency to escalate these real, well, here's this guy I see on the elevator every day. He looks so depressed. I just got to take him home with me tonight and care for him. Okay? And when they find that there are all of these people around, they start numbing off. Because the expectation is if I'm going to get involved with somebody, it's got to be very intense and very seriously committed. I have to shrink my social world to nearly nothing. Because it's not okay to have superficial involvement. Normal people have superficial involvement, and it's okay. And if a superficial friend is hurting real bad, that's fine, but it's not my problem. Okay? Second level up is companionship. Okay? A companion is a personal relationship where two persons associate for the purpose of sharing common activities. Okay, a companion is somebody, for example, I have a friend who I go and see Charles Bronson movies with. Sick, yes. Fun, lovely. Really love it. Okay? Now, that is a shared activity. Now, what happens is I pick up the phone, I call him, I say, hey, Joe, let's go see the new Charles Bronson flick. And he may say, I really don't want to do that. Why don't we go and do something else? And I say, I really want to see the movie. Thank you very much. And I hang up the phone and I call somebody else and say, hey, let's go see this movie. The activity in companionship, the activity is more important than the person. Let me repeat this. The nature of companionship is that the shared activity is more important than the person, and the person becomes interchangeable. And that's okay. What does that do to your gut? That's okay. It's okay for me to want to go to a movie and go out and poll people and say, who wants to see the movie? And somebody says, gee, I really want to go out and shop. And I say, I don't want to shop. I want to see a movie. Oh, please, please. No. And it's okay for me to say no, recognizing that I'm inviting that person into a companionship interaction. Now, the next level up is a friendship. And a friendship is the reverse. In a friendship, if two people associate for the purpose of mutual support and enjoyment of each other. When I have a friend, the person is important, the activity is secondary. So in other words, if I'm calling somebody up and I want to go bowling, does anyone bowl anymore? I don't think so. Or if I want to go and play tennis or backgammon or cards and I call people up and they don't want to do it, too bad, I'll find somebody else. That's companionship. But if I want friendship, I'm going to call you up and say, I want to spend time with you. Then we decide on the context or the shared activity in which we're going to do that. But then, if I want to see a movie and that person doesn't, we begin changing the activities because our primary goal is to spend time with each other. Now, when two people relate, they relate on a whole bunch of different levels. Now, let's just take these two to show you how we get into trouble. A man comes home from work. He is married. His wife also works, and they come home in the evening. Now, the man is really dying that night to go out and see a movie. His wife is really lonely and wants to spend some good intimate time with the husband. The husband is companion-oriented that night, wants somebody to share a movie with him. The wife is friendship-oriented that evening. She wants this person to be a friend and spend time with him. So they come together, of course, coming from dysfunctional families. They don't recognize there are different relationship levels. They have never talked about this. So the husband invites the wife into a companionship role and says, let's go see the new movie that's out. And the wife says, I really don't want to go see the movie. Let's just cuddle up in front of the TV and spend some time or listen to music and talk. He says, well, I'll tell you what. You stay home and watch TV. I'm going to call Jack and we're going to go out and see the movie. What happens? The wife gets violently upset. What the hell? You don't care about me. You don't love me. You don't buy. Argument ensues, and the husband said, women are nuts. What difference does it make that I want to see a movie? What's the problem here? They are operating at different levels of relationship expectation. Okay? So what do we have? Superficial involvement, companionship, the activity comes first, the person comes second. Then we have friendship. The person comes first, the activity comes second. The next level we have is a loving relationship, romantic love. This is a friendship in which there is shared passion, sensuality, and sexuality. The express purpose of a romantic relationship is to have a sexy friend. That's what it's all about. If you are having sex with someone who is not your friend, you are into a superficial relationship that doesn't even deserve, you know, that sexuality without a basis of friendship is not romantic love. You may think it is, but it isn't. It is a shared activity, sometimes at a superficial level. Okay? Now, are you getting into this way of thinking a little bit? Okay? Now, there's one other type of relationship. Oftentimes, you meet somebody superficially, you like them. You decide, now, I'm trying to share with you the sequence of how to build a relationship. Okay? So listen to me. These steps kind of go. You meet somebody superficially, and you observe them with no commitment. Got the picture? And you engage your brain and you think. You engage your gut and you react. You say, do I like this person? Do I feel good about them? As I observe them, do they seem to be sane? Okay? That is not an awful thing to do, to evaluate the sanity of a prospective partner. Okay? Now, once you decide this person is probably good for me, and I feel good about them, then the next step is you invite the person into a companionship with you. Let us go and do something together. Why? Companions are interchangeable. There is limited commitment or involvement there. Is this making sense? So you are still safe. Okay? And typically, you should structure the more involving or distracting the activity, the safer you are. The safest first date typically is a movie. Or a dinner party, something with other people where there's not an opportunity for real intense alone time. Because now you can be kind of safe, observe the other person, see how they interact with others. You know, if the person you're going out with wants to punch out the ticket agent at the movie, because they expected him to pay for the ticket, you know, and that might give you a warning sign. You know what I mean? You might be able to say, perhaps this isn't a good idea. Okay? Then after the companionship goes and you observe, you know, if you begin to notice in your head that this person's a little bit flaco, or if you begin to feel bad about what's going on, you bow out. Then the next level is you start treating them as a friend. You start spending more and more unstructured time with them so you can get to know them as a person, and it's that you let the relationship evolve so that you become a closer and closer friend of theirs. Then, as the friendship develops, out of that friendship emerges sexuality.
What?
Hey, Gorski, you got that Bass Ackwards. You know, I mean, you meet somebody, and all of a sudden your gonads go off, and it gives you the message. You know what I mean? You see? Now, I hate to suggest that many of us think with that part of our body in the early phases of the relationship. You know, but it happens quite a bit. Sexuality, if it is the primary foundation of a relationship, will 90% of the time lead you into a dysfunctional relationship. Okay? It really will. The relationships that survive are the relationships where sexuality emerges out of a foundation of friendship, and the relationship has moved through stages. From superficial involvement to companionship to friendship to romantic love. Now, once you're in love with somebody, it's not over. Don't you die and go to heaven at that point? What do you mean? That's what my whole life is about, isn't it? To be in love? And when that love happens, I'm going to be wonderful. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be fixed. My life's going to... Isn't that what it's... No. Because then, romantic love emerges into a functional association with the other person. As you begin to share your life with that other person, you make commitments in the real world to meet each other's physical and emotional and social needs. It means if that person gets cancer, you don't walk out on them. It means you participate together to pay the bills, to pay the rent, to keep your house going. If you have children, you're making real world commitments, not taken lightly. And typically, in the old days, this was called marriage. Okay? But now, in the 1980s, there is a pre-marriage for most people, and we don't have a good word for it. It's called living together or cohabiting, or I never had a good word for that when I was involved in it. We need one, though, something that will legitimize that for what it is. Because functional association, now it's two stages. Typically, people live together, then they get married. Okay? Now, when you look at it this way, you begin to recognize that normal people do not get married 2 weeks after they meet their partner. That's not normal. That's not healthy. Normal people may meet somebody and go to bed with them on the first date, but they realize half of that thrill is like putting one bullet in the chamber of a six shotgun, spinning the chamber and holding it up to your head. It may be that you develop some other things in common other than sexuality, or it may be you walk away with herpes or AIDS. You don't know. You don't know. You haven't got the foggiest idea. It's high-risk sex. It's high-risk relationships. But, of course, when my gonads do the talking, it's got to be right, right? We use our sexuality to shut off our brain and to shut off our emotions. Okay? Now, with this in mind, let's take a look at what happens in addictive relationships. As the addictive relationship moves from superficial involvement into companionship, into friendship, into romantic love, into functional association, you know, in about 22 minutes after you meet this person. I understand that there is an ACA who wrote a book called The First 5 Minutes, and he describes all of those steps. What happens? Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to divide the addictive relationship into seven characteristics, just so we can think about them. In reality, you know, there are two types of people in the world. Do you know that? The first type of people divides people into types. The other type of person doesn't. Now, I'm the first type of person. I divide people into types, so please bear with me. These things are artificial, but it helps us to think about the issue. There are seven major ways in which addictive relationships work that are essentially different from healthy relationships. Seven major ways that dysfunctional relationships operate that are different from functional relationships. And we're going to talk about these. The first area, I call it magical or unrealistic expectations. Before you ever meet your partner. Before you ever meet your partner. We know what this relationship's going to be. Okay? I believe an intimate relationship will make me and my life better without the need to think better or act better. Am I right? Let me think about this. I know that by the mere fact of involvement with this person, every aspect of me and my life will improve, and I won't have to do dingleberries about it. It will just automatically get better. I will be fixed. It will fix me or make me something I'm not with no or very little effort. That's magical thinking. And we're going to talk about the antidote to that. Now, the next thing is instant gratification. Okay? The only relationships that will serve as addictive relationships are those that are based on a foundation of intense sexuality. Bells go off. Whistles go off. You know, I mean, you just can't wait. You know this person in you is just tremendous animal magnetism. Now, if you are single and you are newly recovering in the ACA program, I make this recommendation to you. When you go to a party or a meeting or a social event and you are looking for a prospective partner and you look across the room and this person leaps out to you with this huge animal magnetism, walk the other way. I don't know how this works. I really don't. But I know that when I was single and dating in my early 20s, I dated four consecutive women who attempted suicide in 1 year. Try it. I mean, I would lay money that you could not do that if there were $1 million on the line. You know how hard it is to find someone who's suicidal and fall in love with them? That's not four in a row. But it was easy. I was at a party and bong, there she was. Now, there we went and there we were and it just unfolded. We be cautious about that because this ability for instant gratification, there is immediate, intense, and continual satisfaction, and I expect this as the basic requirement of my partner. And let me underline this. I expect my partner to be able to provide me with immediate, instant, and continuous gratification anytime I want it. Isn't that what love's all about, guys? Isn't it? I love you. Blow my mind. On demand. What does that? What is capable of blowing our mind on demand? Anybody here recovering from a chemical dependency? Remember that lady cocaine, that lady heroin, that, or if you're a lady, you know, the man cocaine, the man heroin. Those things blow our minds on demand. And what we are doing is looking for a living, breathing drug with the appropriate sex organs. That's really what we're looking for because we've been taught this. If you come from an alcoholic family, what is the only positive love relationship you have ever witnessed? The love relationship between your addicted parent and their drug. that is the only successful love relationship you've witnessed. Think about that. Think about that. And as a result, even if you have chosen not to use the drug, you have witnessed that effect. You witnessed that all-consuming passion and said, this is the only thing that won't abandon me. I've got to get that feeling somewhere, and so I'm going to select people that can provide it. And that feeling requires an adrenaline surge along with sexual attraction. Boom, 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 boom. When your heart starts beating, what feeling is that typically associated with? Fear. One woman came in and says, I don't understand it. I always find men who beat me. She said, I don't understand. I said, well, where do you go to meet men? She says, oh, I go to the biker bar. I says, oh, well, what do you do there? She says, well, I put on a black leather mini skirt, and I put bumper stickers on my car that say, have you been laid lately? I pull up in front of the place, and I go in, and I find somebody who I'm really attracted to. You know, and these bikers are really misunderstood. Everyone thinks they're really bad people, but these are tender, sensitive, caring people that are just misunderstood by society. And then I get involved with one of these people, and lo and behold, he beats me. I said, did you ever think there might be a selection error going on here? And she looks at me and says, well, what do you mean? I says, well, couldn't you try to meet men somewhere else? She looks at me and gets a disgusted look on her face and says, where do you want me to go to meet men? To church or something? I said, well, you know. Okay, but you see how this works? And then when we began exploring this in therapy together, what she began to discover is she was scared going into this bar. And part of the role modeling of the love relationship, remember, we're imitating the relationship of the love between our addicted parents and their chemical. And what did we always feel when we witnessed that love relationship? Fear. So the addictive relationship, this foundation of fear, is confused with passion, is confused with excitement. And the scary components of this are very important. Now, we move on. The next characteristic is dishonesty. Dishonesty. The belief that the relationship will be destroyed if I know everything there is to know about my partner and they know everything there is to know about me. I can't be honest. He'd leave me. She'd leave me. We wouldn't work out together. The whole thing will crumble into dust. Does this make sense? So now come the no-talk rules. I can't talk about certain aspects of my inner experience. I can't give you feedback about certain aspects of your experiences or what you're doing, how you impact upon me. There are no-talk rules. And these no-talk rules are necessary to keep the fear alive, to keep the excitement alive, to keep the sexual passion going. But now, because I can't be honest, I got to work at this sneakily, okay? Now comes the attempts at compulsive over-control. Because I have to keep the climate just right so the relationship will blow my mind on demand. Okay? It's got to be perfect. The relationship's got to work. I got to make this relationship work. So what we look at is the belief that without intense continuous conscious effort, the relationship will self-destruct. You ever notice this? I have to work at it all the time. And there even comes this belief that if I stop thinking about it, the relationship, even for a moment, it will crumble into dust. So we become obsessed with the relationship. We begin thinking about the relationship when it would be more appropriate to think about other things. Okay? We become compelled with the compulsion becomes overwhelming. You know, Bob mentioned yesterday that he would meet a lady and then they'd kind of sink out of sight for 3 weeks. Everything else in the life becomes secondary. Nothing else counts. And then you kind of resurface a little while later and somebody says, hey, who's that? You know, that person's maybe not very good for you. And you resubmerge again, okay? Because now you have totally rearranged your value system around this person. Right? So you're trying to compulsively over-control the situation. This tends to lead just to a tad of trust problems. Because remember, you got two people trying to do this to each other. I can't let you know who I am or what I want or what I need because you'll leave me. The other person says, I can't let you know who I am, what I want, or what I need, or you'll leave me, so I'm going to trick you into giving me what I want without telling you about it. That's the essence of compulsive over-control. Okay? And you expect the other person to read your mind, and if they don't recognize that you want something and then they don't give it to you, you get all upset and you manipulate and so on. This leads to a lack of trust. There is persistently alternating doubts about myself and my partner. And what do I mean by that? Sometimes I think there must be something wrong with me because this relationship's failing. I must be inherently defective and I feel a sense of shame. Or I must be doing something wrong and I feel a sense of guilt. And then I say, no, it's not me, it's them. And I go into blaming and scapegoating. There must be something inherently wrong with them. Do you ever find yourself complaining about your partner? What a bitch or bastard I am married to or involved with. Do they really, and you go on with the litany of everything they have done wrong. Except you have made a mistake and you're talking to somebody with some maturity in the program. And after you go on for 20, 30, 45 minutes, hour and a half, you know, it depends on how bad a day it's been, they look at you and say, gee, what is it about you that attracts somebody like that? And what is it about you that you want to stay involved with somebody like that? So where does it lead right back to? It always comes back home. If you are hooked up with the world's first-class loser, what's wrong with you that you are? So you see the alternating doubts? Then I get back into the shame and guilt. I must be defective or doing something wrong until I wallow and I say, no, it's not my fault. It's their fault. You blame them. But eventually you got to come back to the issue. Who made the decision to get into that relationship? And who's making the decision on a day-to-day basis to stay in that relationship? You are. And then the fundamental question becomes why? But you see, you can't answer that because you can't be honest. You got no talk rule. And besides that, the sex is so good. Wow, is it good. Boom, we merge into one and it's a spiritual experience. The lights blow out and we melt into the universe and our atoms blow and then we come back. Big Bang Theory to the max, you know what I mean? And other than that, I don't expect a damn thing from you. Just do that whenever I want you to, okay? Right? Now, because we've got to protect this experience, just like the alcoholic protects his drugs, what does an alcoholic do when they really get to need their booze? Do they leave it out so everyone can help themselves? Coke addict, do they throw all their coke on the table and say, hey, gal, help yourself? Or do they hide their supply? They typically hide their supply. In addictive relationships, you do the same thing. You isolate. Nobody's going to get near my partner. We're going to hole up all alone, and we're going to just suck ourselves off away from everybody else, and no one is going to share in this marvelous experience we're having. It's going to be us alone, because nobody can understand the deep religious nature of this experience. So you become isolated. There is a need to hide the true nature of the relationship from other people. The relationship becomes a closed system. Now, you can tell, if you're in ACA, when your relationship is getting a little bit on the dysfunctional side, because you will feel this strange feeling in the pit of your stomach when you consider bringing your partner around your ACA friend. And you will have a real lot of trouble inviting your ACA friends to share social activities and so on with you and your partner. Of course, because you don't want your privacy violated. Or is it because maybe there's some stinking stuff going on in the relationship, you don't want it exposed, you don't want to look at it. Finally, this produces a repeating cycle of pain. There is a cycle of desperate action. I'll do anything to make this relationship work. Followed by short-term intense pleasure. My mind blows out of my circuits and it is so wonderful. It is so good. It was worth the beating. It was worth the argument. It was worth the fight. It was worth the 6 weeks of ripping my guts to shreds to get this night of pleasure. And then it's what happens? It blows up again. More pain, and now I become disillusioned. Maybe this is never going to work, and I blame my partner. Then I start blaming myself and say, it is my fault. I'll try again. And I go through the cycle of desperate action again until finally, typically what happens is I shit can that relationship. Say, that's over, no more. And then I go out and look for another person that'll blow my mind at a party. And I start the same process all over again. Huh. There's nothing to this at all. I can see I've got to go back to the drawing board with this. This really doesn't work. Now, what I would like to do is I'd like to share with you how a healthy relationship is different. Are you curious? Okay. Now, remember, the first thing we talked about is relationships progressing through levels of development. Relationship as a developmental process of growing in each other's presence. Okay? Now, I just want to reemphasize this because, you know, I've done a lot of counseling with recovering people, you know, people divorced and single and this kind of stuff. And, you know, one guy came to me and says, you know, I can't understand it. Women will go out with me for the first date, no problem, but they don't ever say yes the second time around. I said, well, tell me, why do you think? He said, I don't have this idea. I said, well, what do? He said, well, on the first date, I pick them up and we go out and we have dinner. Nice, quiet restaurant all by ourselves where we can talk and get to know each other. And I said, well, how do you handle the date? He said, well, first thing I feel is I have to be rigorously honest. So I pick him up, I take him to the restaurant, I sit down, and we order, and then I say, you're aware that I'm a recovering alcoholic, aren't you? Let me tell you my story. And then they whip out their whole AA story, including all the incidents of past female abuse, you know, and all of this now. And then they look at the person and say, okay, so now you know I'm an alcoholic. You don't still want to go out with me, do you? And the person says, well, you know, that's okay. I understand that. It's okay that you're an alcoholic. Okay. I'm also a heroin addict. You know, I got addicted to it. Now are you willing to go out with me? Well, and they just keep, you know, but of course this is just sharing. Now, a rule if you want to have a healthy, intimate relationship. Your ACA story does not get shared till at least date 10. Seriously. Do you know what a healthy person's going to do if they take somebody out on the first date and they start telling this horrendously dysfunctional story of their life? Now, what an ACA would do is they'd marry them. What a healthy person does is says, this smacks of problems, I'm going to distance this person and look for somebody who's able to relate in a sane, context-appropriate way for a first date. But our need for instant gratification doesn't let us do this. Go out on a first date and just do something together, have a cup of coffee, talk a little bit, go home. Don't sleep with him or her the first date. My God. This is heresy. If you're in love, you're in love. Right? All right. Now, that's the first thing. The first difference is the addictive relationship is blown into intense interpersonal risking and sharing instantaneously. And that's the demand. The healthy relationship builds slowly and gradually where people test each other to determine if future sharing is safe. This is healthy. There are sickies out there. I'm sure there are none in this room because we all got well. But out in the world, there are sickies. Who's going to protect you from the sickies? You are. And how do you do that? By taking it slow and systematically and having a game plan. And if you come from a dysfunctional family, when you start dating somebody, at every step of the process, you'd better run back to your sponsor and run back to your meeting and say, this is what happened, tell me what you think. Does this smack of health or does this smack of dysfunction? Okay? Because you need a reality test. Because I'll tell you, when you conduct a relationship this way, it will feel abnormal. Because for you, normal is addictive. And when you slow down and say, I'm going to take 6 to 10 weeks to decide if I really want to get involved with this person. 6 to 10 weeks. That's almost 3 months. I can't wait.
Well, how long has it been since you've had sex?
A year and a half. I can't wait to...
But now this is healthy self-protection. Now this way, now let me tell you how this frees you. You don't have to only pick perfect people to go out on a first date with.
Ah. Oh.
Because remember, you're now selecting, and anyone where the gong goes off, you're walking away from them. And who are you selecting? Let me give you a hint. Boring people. Boring people. Okay? You select somebody where the bongs don't go off, and I encourage all of you to experiment with dating boring people. Okay? Now, they don't have to be real boring, but someone where the gongs don't go off. Now, the next thing, all right? So, help addictive relationships can happen instantaneously. The sex organs do the thinking, and the sex organs do the talking. There is no developmental process of getting to know each other. There is no self-protective mechanism built into the relationship. Important concept. Build a self-protective mechanism into your relationship. Very vital, especially in early ACA recovery. Make sure you can protect yourself. As a matter of fact, I recommend this. I recommend you set up a very firm, I do not go to bed on the first date policy. Now, how many dates you have to consciously say, is it one, two, three, whatever, but make a firm commitment to that. Because the most painful thing that people find is that a lot of people view sexuality as a casual affair. And you go out on a first date, and you go to bed with somebody, they never call you back. Now, this used to be the exclusive province of men abusing women this way. It's no longer the exclusive province of men. Men, how many of you have had that happen to you with a lady? Okay? See, now women are engaging in that particular sport also now. And the way you find out is if you go out with them and you say, no, I'm not going to go to bed with you tonight, they'll just never call you again. Because they wouldn't call you again even if you had. So you can screen that out. You have to build self-protective mechanisms in and a no-sex rule for somewhere between 1 to 3 days. Okay? And now the other rule is never have sex with your partner if you don't genuinely in your gut feel good about them. Never go to bed with somebody out of guilt. Never go to bed with somebody out of obligation. Those two feelings are the hallmark of addictive relationships. And above all, never go to bed with anyone because you believe it will change them. Okay? Now, secondly, dysfunctional relationships are based on magical or unrealistic expectations. I expect that this relationship will somehow magically change me. Healthy relationships are based on rational and realistic expectations. Rational and realistic. What does it mean? All right, I'm unemployed, and I get into a healthy relationship. What is different? I'm an unemployed person with a healthy relationship. That's it. Means I have a good intimate relationship. I have a good lover, friend, companion who I can talk to about the stress of being unemployed. Does it give me a job? No. Let's say I'm an emotionally unhappy person who has a healthy, intimate relationship. What's going to be different? I'm going to be an emotionally unhappy person with a good, intimate relationship. I'm a dumb person. And I'm single, and I meet a person, and I have a healthy, intimate relationship. I'm going to be a dumb person with a good relationship. Nothing else is going to change. Except for the fact of the relationship. This includes, ladies and gentlemen, getting married. The only thing marriage will do is make your life worse for a little while because of the stress. And believe me, this is true. Have any of you had it? You're living together with somebody for a while, then you get married and it destroyed a good love relationship? The reason is when you get married, you unconsciously start acting out the wife-husband role expectations you learned in your family. And it's an unconscious process and it requires effort to overcome this, okay? But you have rational, realistic expectations. Having a good relationship will give me a good relationship. It won't fix anything else. So here's another fundamental principle. First the self, then the possibility of healthy intimacy. You first develop a healthy self, then you have the possibility of healthy intimacy. You only have the possibility to attract to you in an intimate relationship someone who approximates the level of emotional health that you possess yourself. Now, this makes it very difficult. One person came to me and says, gee, I don't attract anything except ugly, mean women. You know, and a woman came to me once, I don't attract anything except mean, rotten men. So I said to the guy, what is it about you that attracts ugly, mean women? What do you do that attracts that? As a lady, and this comes out of very personal therapy. I went into therapy, and here I am, I was 245 pounds. I was working 80 hours a week. I did nothing but work and collapse and sleep. I was psychotically obsessed with my work. I could not communicate. I would have monopolized conversations. I had underlying anger and hostility. And I thought once I got my career together, I'd automatically find a love relationship, and it didn't materialize. So I went into therapy, you know, to find out why. And the therapist says, well, Terry, what kind of woman do you want? And I says, well, I want a young, attractive woman, you know, nice personality. athletic, you know, she's got to be athletic. She's got to have a lot of interest, a lot of friends, good social activities, you know, sports-minded, you know, good personality. And, you know, she's got to have all of these things going for her. And he listened to me, and he nodded a little bit, and then he looked at me, and he says, Terry, no, I'm going to ask you a question. I says, yes. He says, you may not like it. I said, well, okay, go ahead. He says, you're sure you can handle it? I said, yeah, I'm sure. He says, okay, Terry, what would a woman like that want with somebody like you? I fired that son of a bitch. There's plenty of therapists in this world. I don't need that sucker messing up my life. So, here's the principle, okay? Now, here's the other principle, you see. People in addictive relationships, you can always tell the people looking for an addictive relationship. What are you doing? I'm looking for someone to love. I want someone to love. If only I could find someone to love. I'm looking for someone to love. I'm looking for love in all the wrong places. You know, I play these songs over and over. The addictive, you know, the hurt so good music, you know what I mean? I can't smile without him. You know, I can't. That type of stuff we go through. And because I'm looking for this relationship. What do healthy people do when they're single? Healthy people are not psychotically obsessed with finding a partner. They're not obsessed with finding somebody to love. They become obsessed. Are you ready for this? And underline this in your mind. They become obsessed with becoming a person who's worthy to be loved.